Today, is it time to panic yet? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the posts covering finance and property news. Today, I'm joined by Damien Klassen. Hi, Damien, nice to see you back.
Yes, good to see you again, Martin.
And I thought we should have a quick conversation because I had a few people sort of running around, you know, screaming and shouting and saying, oh, the end of the world, the end of the world. But actually, you know, when you look at it, there's conflicting data, right? So there's a new report out from the US from Bank of America suggesting that people are moving to cash at the fastest rate since the COVID crisis at one hand. On the other hand, if you look at markets, then not much to see here. This is the S&P 500, which is, you know, down a little, but really not down much. And it seems to me, I don't know what you think, but a lot of people seem to be just looking through it and saying, oh, this won't go on for very long, nothing much to see here. But I wondered from a sort of a portfolio management perspective, and of course, you've got quite a few different people with different needs. How do you think about it, and what are you looking at, and you know, where are you in this spectrum of everything's fine, nothing to see here, despite interest rates going up, despite the conflict probably going on for longer than expected, despite the fact there's probably not a way out necessarily in the short term, compared with everybody saying, oh, market's saying nothing to see here?
Yeah, well, we've raised a lot of cash. We're sort of it's a mixture of expensive markets and a big downside. So it's not asymmetrical. There's this sharp drop off if everything goes wrong. And the question then for us is sort of this part about saying, well, is Trump going to reverse course? Because, you know, he is well known for reversing course, or is he just digging, has he dug himself too deep of a hole? And you know, while there might have been some initial off ramps, you know, the question now is, even if he just said, you know, job done, solved it all, and ships sail off, you know, will Iran actually open the Straits of Hormuz at that point? Or are they going to say, no, we're looking for security guarantees. We're keeping it shut until we get, you know, some actual guarantees or some actual, you know, re-entry back into the world market or whatever it is that they're going to need. And so, yeah, it's just sort of this weird part where, you know, if you take a step back from the whole situation and you go, excluding this, excluding the Middle East, so ignore the Middle East out of this and pretend it didn't exist. You know, the global outlook for equities is great. You know, you've got a sort of a weakish consumer, cooling inflation, you know, possibly lower interest rates. At the same time, you know, except in Australia, lower interest rates. But at the same time, you've got these corporate earnings booming and this huge, you know, AI-driven capital expenditure that's sort of making the dot-com capex boom blush in a way. You know, you get deregulatory tailwinds, you've got massive government deficits running. It's all this recipe for quite sustained higher margins for companies. But then you've got this whole, you know, what's happening in terms of in the Middle East. And can that just knock all of this off track? And, you know, there's some concerns we have around the CapEx side that you know, helium shortages can that's probably one of the more imminent ones we're expecting on our list of things to come up is when do we actually start seeing some shutdowns in terms of those. Then you start looking at, yeah, the problems if we do hit significant levels of oil, what it's going to do to demand, will the consumer be strong enough to hold up through those supply chain type issues, as you start talking about, you know, fertilizer and growing season and you know, there's CapEx, sorry, not CapEx, inflation sort of going, you know, it doesn't seem as bad as what we saw during the COVID in terms of shortages, but, you know, could we have supply chains hits to, you know, that come from there? Yeah, sure. I think there's certainly some we can certainly see a mini sort of cycle of inflation coming out of that. And then that question about, will markets sort of eventually panic? And I think there's this part that we sort of think about, you know, it's sort of this Minsky-esque sort of irony at play here. So basically, Minsky's sort of insight was that stability is destabilizing in the sense that if you go through too long of a period of stability, then companies just start gearing up until things get more unstable. Is it saying, well, if I can, you know, if I can borrow to a certain level and I know that I'm relatively safe and the economy goes up and down, then that's my level. And now the economy doesn't go up and down as much. Oh, I can actually, that means I can borrow more and then borrow more until eventually you hit this stage where the whole thing falls apart. And I sort of feel in a way, Trump's a little bit the same in that, he needs to pivot, and he sort of needs markets in a way to pivot. He needs markets to panic in order for him to go, oh, actually, this is important. I need to switch. And so the fact we're seeing sort of stable markets is almost as if it's giving him permission to say, oh, well, maybe I'm, everyone told me I was wrong and they're going to do all this wrong, and it's going to be the end of the world if I do this. But I decided to do it anyway, and see, I'm right. Markets haven't panicked yet. And so maybe that there's that part about, if he reverse course early enough, then this stuff doesn't play out. But if he waits too late, then all of a sudden we do start seeing these big problems that are just going to take months to get out of again. So I think there's sort of like that. The question is, do we need to see a market panic to see him reverse, and is that the time then to stick the cash back in again? And if he doesn't reverse and he decides, no, you know what, this is the hill he wants to die on, maybe you should be holding a lot more cash, and that's sort of the way we're treating it at the moment.
Well, I've got the view it's a Schrodinger's crisis at the moment. It's sort of half there and half not there, right? Because
Yeah,
if you
is the
look
cat dead or alive? We don't
at,
know.
exactly, we won't know until down the track a bit. But, just on the oil, so the oil is still knocking. This is the Brent oil futures knocking around 101, 102, which is quite interesting. And one of the observations that I picked up the other day, which I thought was quite fascinating, was a lot of it is actually to do with speculation. So, in fact, there are a lot of hedge funds and other people taking very significant positions in the oil market. So I've always got the question: to what extent is the real market actually being influenced by the all the bets being taken by hedge funds and things? And to what extent is that actually masking, some of the other stuff that's really going on? And it's hard to know, but I think there are people taking quite big positions and taking big bets because in the Schrodinger's cat world of it may be bad, but it may not be bad. Well, people are going to take bets, aren't they?
Yeah. So look, we've got four big sort of things we're watching in terms of, well, there's a whole bunch of ones. I'll talk about some of them, but the four big commodities we're watching at the moment, oil, gas, fertilizers, and helium. Now, the oil side of it is actually the one that's sort of the least acute, if you know what I mean. It's got the big, it will have the biggest effect in the end, but it's the one where we do have quite significant. Oh, sorry, when I say we, I'm not talking about Australia. I'm talking about the world outside Australia. It does have quite significant stockpiles, and so it could be offline for a while. You draw down the stockpiles. It's not going to be a crisis mode. Whereas some of these other ones, natural gas, fertilizers, helium, just don't have the same types of stockpiles. And I do want to talk about that a little bit in focus. The other one, the thing I think that's really interesting on the oil side is, so we manage two different sort of sets of portfolios in a way. Some that are the multi-asset ones where we're sort of saying, okay, when do we go to cash? When don't we go to cash? But we have a lot of people who come to us and just say, I just want to buy an Aussie equities or an international equities portfolio for me, and be 100% invested, and then they will then hold cash elsewhere or do whatever they feel like. And so within those, we're obviously looking for safety as well. And like we do have a reasonable amount of oil and gas, but in a way, it's sort of a bit of a pyrrhic victory, I think, for these sectors, in that they're going through these high prices, but it's a short-term win. So you're going to get somewhere between, I don't know, 2 or 3 months of high prices, or maybe 3 or 4 years of high prices, but it just means we're accelerating away from fossil fuels so much faster. So the Ukraine war was a shot across the bows for Europe and China to sort of get away from fossil fuels and get more, whether it be nuclear power, whether it be hydro, whether it be solar, wind, or whatever it is. That has really ramped up significantly since the Ukraine war started. It's going to go to another level again after this. Like it's the and keep in mind, these sectors, there's some exponential growth in so far as, you set up a new solar factory to put out whatever, 10 units more of solar panels into the world. That's now putting out 10 every year. That's going to go keep on going. And then somebody else builds another factory to put out another 10 more units. Well, now you've got 20 units coming out, and in it's a the capacity to produce that has got this long tail on the end of it. So the demand, it's not just the demand for the first part. It's that part about, oh, now you're going to be producing this stuff just year after year after year. And so yeah, I do think there's that. Do I want to hide in the oil and gas sector? Not really. I've certainly got exposure in that sector, but I'm looking for when to get out of that, because I do think that's sort of a short-term, short-term little bit of a win. If you're really looking to play it, you would play it in the commodities. And I think that's the way traders are looking at it as well. They're saying, okay, I know the oil price is going to shoot up to whatever levels if this gets going on. That's where I'll get my gain from it. Whereas you won't see if the oil price goes, from $60 to, $180, triples in price, the stocks aren't going to triple in price. Because the people who are looking at that and go, yeah, great, you get 2, 3 years of these high earnings, but then I'm knocking 5 or 10 years off the end of your company, where the company's just not going to be around anymore, as everyone sort of converts across just faster to get away from this.
It's very interesting. And just on the oil, so just so people get a bit of a sense of it, around 31%, give or take, 30 to 31% come from the Middle East. There are other sources as well. North America, of course, a huge, an influential oil producer and gas producer. And of course, Trump the other day said, well, if prices go up, we win because we actually make more money. Although, of course, it's not as
Sorry,
clear as that. It's not as clear as that.
And one of the things, actually, that was one of the ones as well. So when I'm looking at oil and gas stocks and say, oh, well, can I get some safety in these ones? The US ones, there's also this added layer of going, well, will Trump actually put some export bans back on? Like it wasn't that long ago that there was export bans on gas and oil in the US. There and limitations on what could actually be exported. Could I see Trump putting an America First thing on this? Absolutely. He could turn around in 6 weeks' time when petrol prices are going high and announce, we're not going to let all this export stuff go out, and we're America First, and we told all you the other countries, if you wanted to open up the Hormuz Straits with us, come and sail your ships over, and you didn't. And so, there's that whole, I think that's the type of thing he'd love to announce. I got us into this problem, but watch me, force the rest of the world to deal with it. And so you might be, if you're investing in US oil shares, maybe the price doesn't go anywhere near as high as what you might get out of Brent or other areas. So yes.
And interestingly,
That's
if you look at the distribution, so this actually just shows you where the oil went from and where it goes to origin and destination. China, of course, other Asian and Oceania, India, South Korea, Japan is where the bulk of it sits. Europe, a smaller amount in terms of oil, although we'll come on to LNG in a second. So it's not uniformly spread around the place either. And I think that's another point. So not everybody's equally impacted by the turning off of the straits for oil.
No, that's right. And what that doesn't tell you as well, that there's two things that one doesn't tell you. One is how much of the actual country, how much of the country's own internal stuff. So it might, you might be looking and going, okay, China gets, 5.4 or something like that from there, but I think they're using 12 or 15. So it's like, okay, so that's like a third of the oil, that is coming from that one place. There might be other countries in there that, the amount they're getting is 80% or 90% of the oil they're getting is coming from that. So that's one thing, that is the actual dependency upon that. The second one is that the first order effect will be, yeah, it'll be harder for these ones, but price is going to sort this out as well. So it's going to be that, there'll be American producers, at least, if we don't see any export bans, who are going to go, okay, I'm selling at, $80 WTI, but actually, if I sell it to, if to somebody down the road who's offered it to me, but actually, if I stick it on a ship, it's going to cost me $5 to get it across to Asia, and they're going to pay me $120. Right, I'll do that. And so there will be, those flows will certainly change with, they'll certainly change with prices. But there will be this immediate impact of, yeah, we had contracts to get the stuff out of Iraq or whatever, and so that's where we're getting it from. Now we've got to go around and outbid other people in other markets in order to get the oil across. So yeah, it'll be felt around the world.
But of course, Australia is particularly badly caught by this because we don't have much production capacity in Australia, and we've got very limited supplies locally, you know, under a month or something. And interestingly, AMP put this chart up the other day to show that if you compare the world oil price compared with the retail petrol price, well, petrol prices have gone up faster than the oil price. And it's not just petrol, but also, of course, jet fuel. And it's worth just noting that actually we get a lot of our jet fuel from China and Singapore. Well, China's saying, uh-uh. And Singapore is saying, I haven't got the inputs to be able to produce it. So that creates one of those follow-on knock-on issues. So I think Australia is a bit more exposed because of the
A lot
local
more
situation.
exposed.
Yeah, and that's a.
I should have. This is one chart. I should have, because I said there's a national oil stockpiles chart that Challenger and Macrobond put together. Yeah, Australia's right at the bottom, like in terms of the number of days of imports. Netherlands got sort of 400 days of imports sitting there, so they sort of got right. I mean, it's a little bit different in that Netherlands actually is a major port, and so it's not all quite for them, but they've got a year's worth of supply sitting there that they can bring out, and Australia has like 30 days or something. And so,
Absolutely.
yeah, we are not in a good place at all in terms of that.
Now, if you then move on to LNG, you know, we produce a lot of LNG in Australia, a lot of it for export. But actually, of course, the problem is that the prices for Australians are actually linked back to the global price. And if you look at the global price, this is the TTF price at the moment, knocking around 51. It was sitting at around 28 to 32 previously. Higher prices. And of course, the other point there is that the choke points are quite interesting. If you look at it here, it shows you that, Straits of Hormuz was a big, big choke point, and where a lot of it comes. We've also got a few others around the place as well. So LNG is one to watch too, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, there's a couple of the I mean, the thing to think about with LNG is, Russia was the world's largest exporter of gas. Not as LNG, most of it was pipeline gas across into Europe. We basically went from, the largest importer into Europe to pretty much zero. There's still some coming through Turkey, but all the northern routes have gone to zero. And so there's been this incredible switch in Europe to go. Over a sort of 3 4 year period to turn off that Russian gas and get the LNG. And so what that's meant is now they've got what if this had happened pre-Ukraine war, it would have been much less of a deal, because they would have said, oh, Russia, can we have some more gas? That's fine, and it would have shipped around. So I guess what I'm saying is it's hitting a world that's already been scrambling to get enough gas to go. It was sort of forecast to come into surplus this year, so there's a little bit of spare, a little bit of breathing capacity. Also, sorry, we thought we were going to have a little bit of breathing capacity, and now that's all gone. You usually have a lot less in terms of the supplies of that. So Europe is, they're not too bad in terms of the supplies. They've started to go through those. They're starting to eat through their inventories, but they still go through this real cyclical part where they're actually in the downswing still at the moment, and they're starting to build up. They'll start up building up supplies over the summer months, and then ready for winter and heating. And so it's not a in a way it's not a bad time to be having. Sorry, I don't want to say it's not a bad time. It's always a bad time to have an energy crisis. But if you're going to have an energy crisis, in terms of heating and cooling, having it in sort of spring autumn is a good idea, because this is the point of time that, there's not as much heating in summer countries, not as much cooling in winter countries. You've got, often you've got quite, these are the times when we set a lot of solar records in Australia, because, you've got a lot of, or, sort of net moving, because you've got a lot of energy in and not a lot used. And so, it's timing wise on the gas side, that winter, the winter heating bit, we've got 6 or 9 months at that. So that's why I guess the oil and the gas, they're important to me, but they're sort of, the oil's got these bigger buffers. Gas doesn't have as big a buffers, but seasonally it's not as bad as it could have been. Then you sort of move into the other ones, the more acute ones, which is the helium and then the and the fertilizer side. Actually, and sorry, I should have talked as well. Some of the other stocks that we're looking at before we move on to these other sectors. So, one often people talk about is uranium, and I do think there is a nuclear renaissance on the way and all that type of stuff like that. And I think this is going to accelerate that. The real problem I have with buying uranium right now is saying, okay, so Martin, you decide you'd want to build yourself a new nuclear power plant to, because you're just sick of relying on all this, and maybe you're going to build a fleet of six of them, you put the Dutton plan into thing. When do you need the fuel? You need the fuel in like 15 years' time, maybe 20 years' time, until you actually need the fuel. There's plenty of time to go. It's probably it's. I'm pretty sure it's faster to make a to get a mine up and running that's going to produce this uranium than what it is to get the power plants up and running. So, yeah, it's sort of a you're taking a pretty long-term bet, I guess, is what I'm saying on that. I'm not saying that you won't see the uranium price spike and there might be a bit of excited seller buying and selling and whatever it is, but for an average plant that's going to take 10 to 15 years to get up and running, buying the fuel for that now because they're going to need it in 15 years' time is it's a long-term bet. And so, yeah.
Well, the UK, of course, have a couple of big nuclear power stations being built at the moment, but they've extended the time for construction and the price has doubled. And even the
Yes.
small modular versions, which everyone's now spruiking as the solution, Rolls-Royce, for example, being very interested in those, they still take quite a long time to do. And there's a lot of planning and everything else. So they're not a short-term solution.
Well, yeah, the thing with the super modular ones, and keeping in mind that they're not that small. Like we're so
It's
like
all
to me, a
relative.
small modular nuclear reactor is one of the ones you stick on a nuclear sub or something like that. They're small and that. But so these small modular reactors and the thing about saying yes, it's going to be these are going to be great. You better put them everywhere. They'll be much cheaper and all that type of stuff. I'm completely comfortable with that as an idea. But build me one. Just build me one first. Show me you can build one, and then I'll start believing. But the number of people have said they're going to do it. And nuclear technology, it's not a it's not like it's a new technology. We've had this thing for what 70 years now, and so it's not like you're like, oh, I've got this brand new way I'm going to do these. So that's one issue with it. And then the other issue around that those small modular reactors. Is that one of the big benefits of one of the things when you do energy is that the bigger your engine, the more efficient it is. And so if you build a big nuclear power plant, it tends to be a lot more efficient because there's just all these economies of scale that go into it. Solar and batteries are unique in that they don't have that same thing in a way. There's a little bit of economies of scale, but largely, I can, they're pretty modular. I can just bang on new solar panels and the efficiency doesn't change. And I can bang on new batteries and the efficiency doesn't change. But pretty much every other type, you want a wind turbine, a bigger one is way more efficient than the smaller ones. A coal-fired power plant, the bigger ones are way more efficient than the smaller ones. And same is true for nuclear. And so you're sort of fighting some physics as well as, what I worry about with small modular reactors in nuclear is one, the execution risk, but the other is this just another sort of bait and switch by the fossil fuel industry in terms of, it was like, oh, carbon capture and storage. Don't worry about doing anything about climate change, Martin. Carbon capture and storage will save us. Just come back in 20, 25 years and we'll sort all the technology out. So don't do anything now. And whether that's the same, I worry that it's the same people pushing it right now as saying, don't worry, keep the coal-fired plants going, keep opening up new coals. Everything will be fine in 20 years' time when small modular reactors are all of a sudden great. And it's like saying, well, yeah, as I said, show me first. And then, yeah. So that's the uranium side. One of the sectors we are heavily invested in is the electricity services sector. So that's been for a while there. Just this whole idea that, look, things are changing on the grid. We are going through, regardless of what wins out or loses out, and is something's going to change. You're going to be building more nuclear, more wind, more solar. Maybe you'll see China going building more coal-fired power plants because they're like, well, China's got a lot of coal locally. Get some off that whole part And when you do that, things need to be designed, things that the grids need to be rebuilt, more transmission lines be put in, stuff need to be plugged in and turned on, and all that type of stuff like that. There's regardless of who controls the states of Hormuz, there's a lot of companies we've got in our portfolios and happy to keep holding that are in that same sort of bit. Companies like Schneider or ABB or Hitachi, Vestas Wind Energy, Wärtsilä, all these companies that are in that process of producing the bits that go into, or the picks and shovels, so to speak, for that is one place.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is fascinating when you start pulling the the whole structure of the, well, the world economy apart into its components. Now, you mentioned helium and you
Yes.
mentioned urea fertilizers. I've held the view for some little time that helium and fertilizers, which of course are significantly linked to their production, they're often side products from the refining process in the Middle East, are significant, not least because, of course, helium is actually directly connected to the production of semiconductors and chips and all of those things. It's hard to store, and a lot of it comes from the Middle East. A lot of fertilizers, again, come from the Middle East. And of course, we're going into growing season now. So those, to me, seem to be two areas which are really quite concerning.
And some imminence to them. And so I'm not saying that I mean, I think a lot of the problems we've seen in the oil and the gas part, we're going to have problems down the future, but there's some buffers. So, yes, it'll be problematic, but if we can stretch the problem over, a year or something like that, so if you come to a quick resolution, you can stretch the problems we've already had over a year, then that sort of all comes out all right. Helium and fertilizers, they've got some imminent issues, and I think they're the ones which we're watching, quite closely. I mean, we're watching all of these, but I think there's some companies that sort of have quite big inventories in terms of what they're talking about in helium, but they seem to be the exception rather than the rule. And so I think what we're watching for is the major fabs like Intel and TSMC about whether they're going to start making some announcements about limited shifts and slowing operations. And that's, that could come as soon as this week or next week, I think. I think there's certainly we're quite keen on what's coming out of those companies. And I think that's the place to be watching at the moment, because that's your sort of imminent, okay, this is really hitting the ground. Maybe you'll see some stuff, because it is used in hospitals as well. I think there will be some announcements about individual hospitals having problems, but I do think the manufacturing part is going to have a bigger effect for stock markets. I think that's the this humanitarian side, you might see some announcements about hospitals, but if you see some of these start saying no, we're making some big changes. And sorry, and the other thing with helium to note is there's this part about, okay, so 40% of the world's gone out, 60% is still there. And so now it's going to the highest bidder. So who's gonna bid the most? And ordinarily you go, okay, so somebody wants to do this for a data center. There's these chips that sell for, hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're the ones that are gonna suck it all up. And you go, yes, that's probably true, but also they actually need a lot more helium, in that the process just relies, they need to keep going back through those helium chambers multiple times, whereas some of the lower end ones don't. And so I think there's going to be a real push for a real bidding war breakout in terms of when you've lost 40, 30 to 40% of the helium, which processes are going to keep going, which ones aren't. And will that lead to some weird breakdowns? And I don't know, but I think there's a reasonable chance. So, one of the things we saw in the pandemic was we saw that the car companies very early pulled all their orders, and then all the IT companies all of a sudden went to TSMC and all these other ones and grabbed those orders, because they're like, oh, everyone's at home, working from home, they're all buying more computers and laptops and webcams and all that type of stuff. And so then when the car companies turned around in 3 months' time and went, oh, actually, we want all that capacity back, actually, there's a boom going on, we want to build these cars, the guy says, sorry, we've already converted the lines over, we're already using it. And so there was this real shortage of cars, and that sort of helped inflation burst along. Are we going to see something similar? I don't know. I suspect there'll be something, but which area, who's going to bid the most, who's going to bid the least? It's going to be I guess the main thing we know is there's going to be shortages. And so you're going to be paying higher prices for a bunch of these things that just need that helium in it.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the price of helium compared to US dollar is not hugely high at the moment, but the question is supply. Urea is another example, right, where the fertilizer story can directly impact future food prices.
Yes, exactly. So now, okay, so yeah, let's talk about that one as well, because that's the and then I want to come back to sort of both of them. What are some of the key things we're watching to get out of this? So urea price sort of over $800, I think, at the moment. Historically, $200 to $300 was more sort of your baseline. It sort of hit 600 to 800 during the Ukraine invasion. So we're already into the sort of panic part of it. Sort of similar levels to what we saw. Not as high as the peaks, but we're certainly up there, and double what we were seeing in this sort of 2024 to 2025 was more like sort of 250 to 450 in terms of prices. And so, I think there's a the important part there is you're going into the planting season now. Where I spoke about the gas being and electricity is like, okay, now's not too bad of a time because we're sort of sitting between seasons and not particularly hot, not particularly cold. The fertilizer is the opposite. This is where people are out. Yes, springtime. In Northern Hemisphere, you're planting whatever crops you're planting. You need to fertilize them, and there's a window. Like if you don't get them away in the next couple of months, then you're just not growing those crops. And there's been a big flip around. There are already farmers in the US are flipping between. I forgot to write down which ones. But there's a crop. I think it's corn to soybeans because you need one of them needs a lot more. Of the nitrogen that you're missing, or the urea that you're missing, and the other one doesn't. And so, there's just this relative pricing you're going to see, I think, in terms of corn prices higher and other prices lower because of what farmers are choosing to grow because of what the fertilizers they can get, and you just the impact of that is very hard to judge. There's going to be various things downstream, things that you just didn't realize that's affecting and putting prices higher in all these different areas again.
And just one more, just one more. Aluminium, right, is another one. So if you look at the aluminium price, it's up significantly. And in fact, Aluminium Bahrain has actually basically talked about a phased production shutdown to conserve raw material supplies. So it goes on and on in terms of, it's not just oil, it's not just LNG, it's all the other things. And these are all things that have significant downstream consequences.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the other one to remember back from the one of the lessons from the pandemic is when prices are being raised by companies and there's an excuse for it, then companies will put the price up by more than what they should. And that's I think a lot of the inflation we saw in a lot of areas was, well, everyone's talking about prices going up. 5 years earlier, your local bakery decides to put its bread prices up by 30%, and you're like, that's an outrage. I'm going somewhere else or whatever it is. Whereas when everyone's putting their prices up everywhere, regardless of whether their input prices have risen, they can just turn around and go, oh, I'm really sorry, I'm putting it up, but you know what it's like, inflation everywhere, And so some of them will be real, but a lot of companies also will just take advantage and go, well, consumers are used to prices going up, so therefore I will put prices up by more.
Yeah, they've got an alibi. They've got an alibi, haven't they? You know. By
Exactly.
the
Exactly.
way, governments have an alibi too. So, oh, we'll have to give out some more money, and so everybody, even the RBA, I suppose, ultimately can say. And by the way, just to contextualize this, remember that the 2-year Aussie bond at 4.5 is still extremely high, and so more broadly, interest rates are rising as well. So, cost of money also going up.
So, let's talk interest rates because that's an issue. It's a really interesting one for bonds. So, we made a huge change in our portfolios on bonds. What we did was because this is a bit of a it's a bit of a two-edged sword because if we're going to recessions and deep recessions and you're like, oh, okay, bond yields are going to fall, but on the flip side, we've got all this inflation around, so therefore they can't fall, and so you've got this sort of this disc disc discontinuity between the two. And there's also the part about saying, well, as if things get bad but not recessionary bad, then now we're talking about inflation going up, but you're not going to have lower interest rates because you're not the recessionary bad. So anyway, so we've basically gone, let's just get out of the long end of this bond curve. Let's get out of the much of the middle end as well, and let's just go inflation-linked bonds across heaps of it. So that's where we've piled into. Now, what's the logic behind that? So, well, how do inflation-linked bonds work? Let me start for that because I think a lot of people sort of don't see what they're like. So you could buy, say, the 2030 Australian inflation-linked bond. You get about a 2.5% yield, so the yield's not particularly high relative to other things, but it does go up at the rate of inflation every year, and the value of your bond also goes up by the rate of inflation. So what happens is you buy the bond for whatever it is, $125, $150, and then every year the amount they're going to give you back at the end goes up by the amount of inflation. So by doing that, I guess what we're saying is we think we're going to see low real bond yields coming out of this. The nominal bond yields might be high because inflation's high, and so nominal bond yields stay high. But we're going to see central banks trying to say, well, we want to have interest rates high enough to try and bring down inflation, but we don't want them so high that we turn it into this huge unemployment, depression type thing. So we're going to try and keep those low. And what types of assets do you want in that scenario? The inflation-linked bonds, look, they're one of the best ones you can get, I suppose. They're not great in terms of it saying you're not going to lose money on them if that's your scenario, and you make a few percent more than what you would have otherwise got out of bonds or cash. But that's sort of one area where we think we've completely flipped our portfolio around to try and say let's try and protect ourselves from upcoming higher inflation, but also look to have some exposure if we do end up in some of these scenarios where you start seeing some recessionary or deep recessionary type things coming out of it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. The other thing observation I'll make is that banks are now, apart from the credit private credit issues which are still washing around, but if you look at CBA, CBA is now up again, not quite as high as it was, but now with higher interest rates, of course, margins are higher. I noticed that the banks all grabbed the extra 0.25% on mortgages immediately, but haven't done as much on the deposit side. Funny that. So again,
That's right.
margin
That's right. We'll get
protection.
round to Martin. Yeah,
In a year or
that's next
two.
quarter's problem.
But what it shows you is that with all of these moving parts, there is no simple solution, right? So if I'm an investor, maybe the answer is just, well, hang tight and see where it goes. Or as you say, maybe there are some changes of portfolio simply because some of the fundamentals have changed. I think there's also a timing question. If you actually are needing to, for example, move into retirement in the relatively short term, your strategy could be quite different than if you're actually going to be thinking, no, I'm talking about 20 years down the track, and it's therefore less of an issue. So it also depends on which investors you're talking about as to how you try and navigate on or just look through it.
Exactly. And especially that, and I think that's especially where our thinking is coming from in things like these inflation-linked bonds. For people who are close to retirement and are like, well, I've got my amount and I can't, this is what I need to retire on. I can't take a 20% or a 50% downturn if that's what happens, and I want to make sure you need more bonds and you need more cash within that portfolio. But then you're like, well, yeah, but what happens if I load up on bonds or I load up on cash, and next thing, inflation's gone ballistic and I'm going backwards, in terms of that. And that's where I think the inflation-linked bonds, give you that peace of mind that yes, I've got something that's inflation. We average 4-5% inflation for the next few years. I'm protected on that side without having to worry about being able to fund a retirement.
Absolutely. So it does depend on individual circumstances. And I guess my last question today, Damien, is there a single leading indicator that you'd say, if that happens, then I know that we're actually into a much, much more difficult situation ahead?
Okay. So there's I'm going to give you a couple of things I'm watching that I think are the sort of key ones. So there's all these different energy prices, whether it be the your oil price and your gas price and fertilizer prices. That's all interesting. Things like refining crack spreads. I think that's an interesting one because it's just a bit of demand supply. Like it's not always the it's, it helps show where the demand and everything's sort of pushing. But the key ones for me that I'm watching is sort of like there's three big things I think are sorry, four big things that we should watch, because one is what Trump says and does, a mixture of the two. So I think what he says is one thing, what he does I think is so saying that he's gonna it's almost all over and it's all sorted, I sort of feel like, well, no, I actually genuinely want to see that. So that's obviously a number one thing. What's he doing, what's he saying? But the external ones, so the helium one, that's a big one, I think is well worth watching, because I think if you saw, I don't know how much they're gonna limit it, and I don't know where they're gonna limit it, and that's the part I'm really keen to see, because is that gonna be devastating for the IT sector, or is it just gonna be that actually it's a little bit of a hit for that whole IT CapEx side actually, but there's a whole bunch of other sectors that are gonna be bearing the brunt of this in terms of whether it be autos or consumer electronics or whatever it is. Like where's the pain gonna get felt on that side? And that's imminent. I'd be surprised if we don't start having announcements within the next 2 weeks. And if we had one this week, it certainly wouldn't be surprising to me at all getting it. So that's our imminent one. The negotiation side is, and so the Omani negotiation side is the other one I really want to watch. So I don't think there's a, well, I'm not an expert on this, but I don't think there's an imminent solution to the whole thing that Trump and we'll come to a deal and everyone will walk away and decide that they're all happy. But there is this deal that's being talked about is sort of a maritime-only ceasefire, and whether there's a fertilizer and medicine corridor that's sort of being done or something like that. Now, that's a positive sign for some of these, and so keeping an eye on what's going to happen there, and no announcement there is a negative sign. I think the fertilizer size in particular, maybe we've got a month, maybe less. There's something we want to see something there on that side. And the other one I'm watching, I suppose, it is worth watching the insurance part as well. So I think that's just there at the moment it's almost 2%. So basically what to take one trip on your boat is going to cost you 2% of the value of your boat to insure it. And I just think why am I watching that? I just think there's an amount of realism, and like they're putting their money on the line. They've got access to some of the best your risk models out there, and all the associated bits that go to it. And so I do think they're less likely to be there's propaganda coming out all over. The first enemy of first victim in every war is the truth, or is that the one, or whatever it is. There's propaganda coming out everywhere. These guys are financially incentivized to come up with the best estimate, and keeping an eye on if those premiums start to drop away, then it's like, well, okay, things are genuinely opening up. And because I do think whatever announcements are made, Trump's going to trumpet them and say this is fantastic, it's the best announcement ever. And but if you don't see insurance rates move, then they're obviously saying, well, this isn't what you thought it was. And if insurance rates all of a sudden are back below 1%, then it's like, okay, this may be a genuine deal, and let's take it from there.
Absolutely. My pick is to look at the water story into the Middle East and the food story into the Middle East, because that's the part that nobody's thinking about at the moment. But of course, they are totally reliant, because they're basically cities in the desert, on saline stripping to be able to actually make water or find other ways of getting water. And of course, food. A lot of food is imported into that area too. To me, that's probably the other significant factor that's worth hanging on to in terms of understanding how this could play out.
Oh, look, if that, I mean, if you started to see attacks on desalination stuff, like that's dramatically, that there's a humanitarian crisis on its way. And whether that means, you get, what's a, I mean, the combined population in that area must be 150, 200 million people. Like, there's probably, if, and they're all reliant on that desalination. And so, that is a, That would be a very bad sign if you start seeing movements on that side.
Absolutely. So I think as we come to the end of this rather impromptu conversation, Damien, the story is not to panic, right? But to do a little bit of forward thinking and saying what if, what if, what if, what if. Keep a track. So be actively engaged and involved in the story and the evolution of this story as it, and be prepared to steer the ship, literally and metaphorically, right? Depending on what you
Yes.
see in terms of whether it's mines or whatever. Because there is a huge level of uncertainty at the moment. But as I often remind myself, truth is that panic moves often are not good moves.
No, that's right. There's been a couple of times you'd needed to go to cash over the last 20 or 30 years. You pick 3 or 4 times, and there's probably been 30 or 40 times where it seemed like you should go to cash. And if every time you think you should go to cash, you did, it definitely would have you definitely would have lost out. And for many people, look, if you're keeping investing, and especially if you're 20 or 30 and you've got a superannuation balance that isn't that big, and you're going to be investing for the next 30, 40 years, and so the amount of more money you're going to put in is way going to dwarf the amount you have at the moment. There's good arguments for saying, look, just stick with it. Takes up you'll buy high sometimes, you'll buy low sometimes. You just stick with it and rely on markets to get you there in the end. If you're close to retirement, you need to really think about these issues. And then there's the whole investment philosophy. Am I going to drift away? Is it like, for us, we're in our tactical portfolios, we'll take a little bit more bonds and cash, or a lot more bonds and cash at certain times, and then we'll go back to equities when we think things are better. But the question is always getting back in. There's a lot of people who are very happy, and we see it all the time. I mean, I talk to people now who we started 8, 9 years ago, and there's people now who are telling me in 8 or 9 years ago that, oh, I was really concerned about markets being too high, and I'm not going to buy in yet. But I'm going to keep talking to you guys, and when markets look good, I'll give you some money. And 8 or 9 years later, and markets have doubled and tripled and halved and everything over that time frame, and it's always been, I just want everything to feel right. Everything's never going to feel right, but you do need to plan to. If you are going to get out of these, you need to plan to get back in. That's probably the biggest, I
And it's
guess,
worth
support I
highlighting
give.
that in the long term, markets go up and to the right because inflation is always there to some extent. And, money supply continues to increase and governments aren't going to dial that back. So, up and to the right ultimately. But the journey is not linear.
And I think we are in a situation where the right now, where the linear stuff is it's way more skewed than normal. No, there's a significant downside. It's getting a relatively high probability, and you need to watch that downside risk.
Well, Damien, thank you very much for that. We'll put links and things below to what the World Fund's and Nucleus Wealth, and I'll get you back on the normal show in a couple of weeks, and we'll see how things have developed then. Thank you very much.
Yes, we'll have a completely different conversation. Yes.
Probably will. See you then. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.